All right. I'm Thomas Roche.
Hello, everybody. Thomas.
And I'm going to... thank you. And I've been given the somewhat burdensome task of ending this this truly amazing 3 days of events about sex and technology. And I'm going to do it by showing you just how little technology I actually know, and going back and talking a little bit about what sexual representation and erotic art has looked like through the years, and what it's going to look like in a year, in 5 years, in 10 years, maybe even in 100 years, if we actually manage to get that far. So I put together a very brief slideshow that is about that has such a small number of data points that it's laughable. But here's the Venus of Willendorf, and this is a good way to illustrate something. What I'm not going to differentiate here, which is I'm not going to differentiate between art that's made for non-sexual reasons or for maybe artistic reasons that a piece of art just happens to be about sex versus art that's made by somebody to turn them on or to turn their partner on or turn somebody else on versus art that's made strictly for a profit. So I'm not really going to go into erotica versus pornography or any of that. I think anthropologists can speculate on why Venus of Willendorf was made, but we're not going to worry too much about that in this. So we've got the Venus, pardon me?
And she's Austrian.
Made entirely of Rice Krispies.
Or why she was made entirely of Rice Krispies, which is what Violet points out. So we've got the Venus of Willendorf.
It's not Rice Krispies. She's like on Austrian territory, and we don't know anything like Rice Krispies. I mean, all that cereal stuff is kind of strange. Like, we like bread and butter on it for breakfast.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Boing, boing.
So we've got the Venus of Willendorf around 25,000 BCE. Then we have... if my computer will respond to me. Then we have, great, this is not centered, but what that says is that this is a pederasty image from 5th century BCE Crete. This is a wall painting from Pompeii, the 1st century CE, and this is a Priapus image from Pompeii, 1st century CE. You'll see that Priapus has a really enormous dong, and that actually was not intended so much to be erotic as it was intended to be humorous, because men with big dicks were apparently considered very silly in Pompeii. They still are, yes. This is an Italian image, and you'll see it's very explicit, and you'll see that it's quite different than the previous, you know, the technology has developed, and what we see is very different. Next, this is, and I want to make sure that we're talking about all forms of creativity, of erotic creativity. Erotic literature is important. Fanny Hill was a very important piece of erotic history, published in 1748. This is a 1910 American edition. It's the only cover I could find. And then this is Shunga from around that same time that Fanny Hill was written. That's a kind of erotic Japanese art. And this is an illustration for de Sade's Juliet in 1800. This is an image from the late 19th century. And this is work from a gentleman called Muybridge, Edward Muybridge, who, let's see if I can get this to look correct, who created this thing called a zoopraxiscope. And one of the first things he did was shoot nude women pouring water on each other. And then there's also going to be some gay wrestling in a minute. Gay wrestling. And then here's women getting in bed, and in a moment there's going to be women wrapping each other up in togas. So obviously this is something that was immediately turned to making erotic art.
It's not surprising that he...
And it has very strange vocal accompaniment. And these are movie stills from shortly after that era, from 1906. This is an early erotic film from Johann Schwarzer, who I think we saw earlier, actually in an earlier presentation. He's an Austrian filmmaker. This is a blowjob from 1925. And this is an image from the 1950s. This is an image from of a novel from 1970, Thy Neighbor's Ass. So you see we've really progressed in terms of the quality of erotic representations. Playboy from 1990. This is Don't Waste It, Taste It from last week. And this is coming soon in November. Make Me Creamy 3, in case you missed the last one. Then I want to talk a little bit about the emergent genres of online porn in particular. This is something that's made with Poser. This is from a place called Beyond Bent. We talked about Poser a little bit earlier as something that has a real low barrier to entry. It's very, very inexpensive, and people are doing really weird freaky, kinky art with it. This is actually based on something from the House of Gord, which is a longtime bondage house that published books that had line illustrations, and now we're doing this 3D illustration. And then this is another one. This is a milking fantasy from that same website. And this one is actually a very strange autoerotic asphyxia fantasy from somebody with a cyber penis from Beyond Ben. So the point I want to make there is that I want to is that basically from one point to the next, from the earliest erotic art to another, there's been this wide variety of development in terms of how erotic art is made. The question I want to ask is, how do those technologies determine what we create? How we as artists are creating art, not in a vacuum, but with the tools that we have at our hand, at hand. Obviously, you know, somebody like Kyle is making tools that are absolutely 100% dependent on available technology or technology that he can invent. Somebody like Violet or I, we're both writers, maybe a little bit less so, but still, and Violet also works in a lot of other genres and a lot of other media, you know, still you're really dependent on the technology. I know that I started to write much, much more when I started to write with a computer. When I wrote by hand, I wrote a lot, lot less, and I probably would write a lot less porn if I had to write by hand. Because, you know, I would need both my hands. Anyway, so that's the question I want to ask. How is your creative process affected now in a world where our available technology changes from month to month? How do you find your creative process being affected by that?
How do I find my creative process affected? Well, for me, as a blogger, I always find some release, if you will, because I can always blog. And I blog, like, you know, like 3 to 6 times a day about sex and or technology, but usually about sex in one form or another. And that helps sort of, like, blow some of the steam off when I'm doing other creative processes, like when I'm working on old-fashioned print media, like books. So when I'm working on a book, it's a much longer process that I work for independent publishers, and so we tend to work on a much shorter timeline than mainstream media. Mainstream media publishers tend to work on an 18-month timeline to get a book out. With independent publishers, you're talking more of a 6-month to 8-month window. But for someone like me, who is, you know, doing old media and new media in both of these genres, I get a lot more satisfaction being able to immediately post, immediately publish, and work in a much, much faster environment, you know, with something like Fleshbot or my own blog, where I can, like, grab a new story, or, you know, I find this porn site and immediately publish it and get satisfaction from it. And I'm also finding frustrations with the type of media that I want to be producing and not having the available technology there. And I can talk more about that in a little bit, but I'll pass it on to Kyle. So. What? We have more than one?
We have two mics now. This is special.
Sorry, yeah. Ian.
So the way I'm coming at it, since I build toys and everything else, it's been enough over the past few years with the since we're keeping up with Moore's Law and everything's coming out so fast and there's so much new that it's enough to just turn you into a short attention span, obsessive compulsive freak when you read the gadget blogs and it's like, oh my god, there's this new technology out there, but I'm currently working on this thing, but I could use this new technology and I should really use it, but I want to finish the first thing, and you never get anything done. So that's the thing. It's also infinitely exciting because it's like, by the time I get the thing that I thought was cool 3 months ago done, oh man, the world has moved on and it's time to relearn all over again and figure out something even newer and better. And really, it becomes an issue of trying to limit myself and go, okay, what's there that hasn't been done yet that I could do now that I don't have to wait for and that I can concentrate on and that'll still be worth it. Mm-hmm. So that's really the way that I look at things for the moment. And yeah, just try to remember to finish something at some point.
Yeah, I'm a little bit distracted because there's a naked woman on this here. So, okay. Basically, I have to add that I'm not a technician. Like, I'm not building things. So, like, still, I'm, I guess, a little bit creative sometimes. And so far, like, I always like watched all those things or like tried to observe the things that are happening. I mean, I'm pretty much a good like observer of popular culture and things that happen, and I try to to put that into like kind of a historic perspective. So where are all the things like emerging from? Where are they coming from? What can we do with it? And nowadays it's like nearly impossible not to be creative on the one hand. And on the other hand, we all know that like 95% of human culture is just like bullshit. So when it's always like the interesting part is like digging yourself through 95% of shit to find like the 5% that are really, really important. So because if you see like something like YouTube, for example, so I'm not really like a big fan of the concept of YouTube, but still there is like, there's a little bit of utopia in this like capitalist, like big money thing called YouTube. And this little utopia is that people can put stuff online. That's it. I mean, we still have to discuss all the things about like, why can they put it online? Who is paying for the bandwidth and how is it financed and all that stuff. So like technology is like, as like Jonathan Cooper-Smith yesterday said, it's neither like good nor bad nor neutral. So that's what I like. It's definitely not neutral, okay? So and I think what I find like on the one hand there's like creativity like in doing creative things, and the other creativity I think is really important is to try to find your way in this like really, really like messed up system to do things without not completely losing your face with that. So not completely like selling your mind and soul to like whatever evil is out there.
Well, I think that it's really good to kind of talk about what you do as somebody who's curating this conference. Would a conference like this have even been possible 20 years ago? Or would it have been held in a very different form?
I mean, I guess it would have been like a little bit more of communication, and I think it would be like a narrow bandwidth of people, because 20 years ago I just used FidoNet, and I don't know how many people used FidoNet back then, and it took like 2 days for an email to be delivered and stuff like that. or like maybe a day or something like that. I mean, that's like exactly the amount of time it took like to ride through the Habsburg Empire to deliver like a letter, yes, like an important letter, I have to say, but still like 20 years ago, I think in the meantime we had like 32 or 64 digital revolutions. I don't know how many, but there are still things happening, and that's and devices are getting like smaller, compacter. You have access to like endless things. Still, there's all these legal issues that like tame down the endless things. But
and I think also we would be talking more about books, and we would be talking about films, and we wouldn't be talking about video blogs, and we wouldn't be talking about podcasts, and we wouldn't be talking about, you know, DVD porn and, you know,
machines.
Yeah, we wouldn't be talking about guys who duct tape dildos to their computers because they think it's fun.
Well, it is. Like, you didn't laugh. But the funny thing is, though, if we didn't have a conference like this soon, there's going to hit a point where geeks like me are going to basically sit in their basements so far ahead of everyone else that by the time we decide to emerge out into the sunlight and go, look at what we have created, no one's going to get it. So it feels like there needs to be a point where we actually start trying to message to the public that, hey, or the mainstream, or whatever the hell you want to call it, the mundanes, that, yes, this stuff's out there, and yes, it's usable right now, and this is the way things are going, and you should, everyone fucks, you should have an influence on it, so.
Well, so that's a good way to get into, earlier Aaron was talking about the different possibilities now for storytelling in pornography and visual media. We're talking about a world now where basically if somebody's willing to take the time, willing to learn some pretty basic software in many cases, they are getting to the point where your average person who's not a trained artist, not a professional artist, can create tentacle porn, for instance, can create alien rape porn, stuff that is fairly out there, fairly represents some fairly I don't want to say fairly unusual fantasies, but some eyebrow-raising fantasies, definitely. And I guess the question is, how, what do you see in the next I mean, even in the next year. But so next year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, what do you see being the different storytelling media that are available for people to create, or Kyle, in the case of you, the different functional art project, if I can call it that, media that are going to be available in our respective genres.
Oh,
okay. First off, do you have YouTube up on there? See if you can hit something. If you can do a YouTube search, there's a piece of software called Eon Human, E-O-N space H-U-M-A-N, and it'd be cool if we could show the demo of that. Because what it is, Second Life, which I work on, I'm actually working on different like avatar fidelity projects right now. Huh?
Demo
Human? Eon, E-O-N. So yeah, Eon Human. And I actually saw this technology at, and scroll down a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Actually, yeah, that's a really slow demo. Let's see here. Yeah, just either one of those will work.
George W. Bush.
Okay.
Not George W. Bush, I'm sorry.
So while this is playing in the background, what Eon Human allows you to do... it's still on the Real Player stuff. You can actually... We've got computer processing moving fast enough now that you can... they have an averaged mesh of the human face, and what they do is you set that up manually over a 2D picture... And then it does the mesh finding and the light finding and everything else to make a 3D image off of that 2D image. So you get a 3D mesh of a face off of something off of Flickr. Think about what that's going to do for porn. You can have the face of anyone, anything, doing anything. There's a program out called Motion Portrait now, which will actually map the facial expressions onto the 3D mesh, which is really fucked up. They did that to me at GDC, and it's one of the first times I've almost puked watching something of myself because they made me speak Japanese and sneeze. And it was just a straight, like, picture of my face. No expression, nothing. They made it do all that in software, and ATI will actually be distributing that with their video cards soon, I believe. So, yeah, there's all sorts of crazy shit we're going to be able to do, and we're snapping that the uncanny valley closed more and more and more, and sky's the limit, really. So, yeah.
I saw very similar technology, and this was a couple years ago at the Las Vegas AVN show, where they had actually created what was sort of a virtual world reality game with Jenna Jameson that starred Jenna Jameson.
Oh yeah, virtually Jenna.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it wasn't enormously great, but it was an interesting technology in that they were kind of creating this virtual world where real people were interacting.
I think I'll take this away from a little bit more of a technical perspective and go back to a writer's or an artist's perspective. And I think that we're going to be seeing more of a revolution in terms of self-publishing happen once again. I think that podcasting and video blogging has been sort of the first wave of self-publishing revolution in terms of like art, and blogging, of course, but who even thinks of blogging anymore? But now what I'm seeing happen, especially with people doing erotic work, is that they're running into terms of use problems, they're running into distribution problems, they're running into problems getting their erotic podcasts, kept on iTunes, because iTunes has basically like corralled, the majority of where all the distribution of podcasts are coming from at this point. They're the biggest podcatcher and distributor. And so, people are making they're making really high quality, really amazing podcasts of erotica and how to, sex ed stuff, and iTunes is only keeping a certain amount in there because they're trying to toe the line. And also, we're seeing, at least especially with me, a lot of frustration coming from a self-publishing perspective where I want to do a certain type of self-publishing with ebooks and with audiobooks, and I'm running into distribution problems once again because people, companies don't want to carry the content, companies don't want to distribute the content, and a lot of the way that the content is purchased and found by mainstream media, or by mainstream consumers, rather, is through regular distribution channels. And these channels right now all have exclusivity agreements. So for instance, I want to make and distribute my own audiobook. I pitched this to my agents and my agency, which is ICM. It's one of the largest talent agencies in the world. And they were like, well, that's a little too racy, and it's just sex ed content, right? And so I thought, okay, well, fine, I'll just fucking do it myself. But in the meantime, I had a large conversation with these agents and about how audiobook distribution is done. And it's basically all done by two or three companies who all have exclusivity agreements with each other that all end up on iTunes and a little bit on Amazon, but not even really on Amazon. And so, you know, so suddenly and it's all DRM'd and it's all locked down and it goes through traditional print publishing channels where it needs to be printed first. And then it gets turned into an audiobook, and then it goes into Audible, who is a subscription service, who is desperately trying to cling onto their subscription service, and which has got to be one of the most antiquated fucking business models I've ever heard of in the world. Pardon anyone who runs a pay site. But especially for this type of content, right? Like for audiobooks, you know, and then what we end up having is like a fucking Harry Potter audiobook for $70 on iTunes. It's like this huge, giant DRM'd file that like no one really knows what to do with. And so for someone like me, I'm just sort of like, okay, I can do that myself, except the boundaries are, these are the main distribution channels. So how do we unlock these distribution channels and get our content out there, especially as erotic artists and erotic writers? So that's been one of my big projects that I'm actually about to launch next week, because I kind of figured out how to do it. And a lot of the way I've been doing it, too, has been thinking about the end user in mind, which no one is thinking about the end user as usual, as we know with sex toys and with mainstream porn. Like, no one's thinking about, like, okay, so I'm like, okay, so what, you know, one of the most popular things about my podcast is the erotica that I read. And so I've always thought, like, well, how cool would it be if you could get, you know, you could cherry pick your own audiobook of like all this hot erotica that you want and then put it on shuffle. Well, the way that the audiobooks work now, they're all one big DRM file, and you couldn't possibly do that with all the different chapters. So with the end user in mind, I'm figuring out how to put together, you know, packages of MP3 files, doing a lot of homework, finding people to host it for me, doing all the packaging myself, doing all the marketing myself, and I think that that's the direction that we're starting to go. And I've pulled a lot of people from a lot of different areas, everyone from people who are self-publishing and running gadget blogs to, you know, people who are doing erotic podcasts and things like that, and writers, and asking them, you know, what their opinion is on ebooks and audiobooks. And I think that's where it's going, but I think it's going to be DIY. And I think that within the next 5 years, I think that iTunes is going to be one of the smallest players in the field, to be quite honest.
I have to say that I've resisted iTunes. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I resist iTunes for various reasons. But basically, I didn't like the way my computer reacted to iTunes. I got a lot of crashes. It just didn't function very well for me. And so I've avoided iTunes, and I've been able to still find a lot of podcasts that are very, very interesting. Johannes, did you have a comment on what's going to be the emergent technologies?
I don't know what will be the emergent technologies, but I know that there is a possibility to like avoid stuff like that. I mean, there's the open source community out there. I mean, there are people like building stuff every day, and most of the time they're technicians and they don't know actually, like, they don't think about content. They just like think about like we need something that is like Photoshop, but it's not Photoshop. It should be free or freeish or whatever. That there are many, many people out there thinking about technology, but there are not so many people thinking about the content and thinking about alternative distribution channels. That's exactly what I think. We should basically be really careful where we put our stuff on. So, I mean, we had the whole situation with Jake Applebaum's censorship thing with Flickr and in Hong Kong and all this stuff. So there's, I mean, if you put something on, I don't know. I mean, how many of you have actually ever read like a license agreement, like for something like Flickr or stuff? Really? Are you really? It's all the nerds.
This is a selective it's, crowd, though.
It's even, yeah. The hardcore, like even the legal nerds, okay? Right. But I mean, to be honest, like I have a Flickr account. And when I like opened up the Flickr account, I didn't read like the license agreement. I didn't do it. And many, many people don't. And I think that like most of the most interesting battles of the future, like concerning creativity, of course, are like legal battles on the one hand, and on the other side, it's like actively getting people to do stuff and not being afraid of like doing stuff, because many people, there's a culture of basically pessimism out there, and a culture of fear, I would actually say, like in many, especially in your country. I mean, I don't have to tell you anything about fear in your country. And I think it's, on the one hand, it's bad to just like say, okay, I mean, we just like forget about that. We'll just like happy and do our stuff because there's some stuff happening that shouldn't happen. But on the other hand, I mean, we can't like end up like in total cultural pessimism and say whatever. I mean, that's the market and that's how it works and just forget it. I mean, we can't like, so we shouldn't be nihilistic about that.
Yeah, I've got one. Okay. Okay, I just wanted to add one more thing too, because I left out video blogging in my self-publishing revolution of porn sermon that I just delivered. But I also wanted to add that, you know, now that there are sites like YouPorn and, you know, and XTube and things like that, it's sort of like, it's really starting to shift, especially, you know, what I'm seeing on Fleshbot. It's like, you know, the things that we're getting a high response from are less and less the mainstream porn releases and more what people are making themselves and producing themselves and putting on sites like YouPorn. And I wish he was still here, but there was a boy here earlier who is working on a copyleft porn project, which I think is really interesting. Yeah. So that's all excellent food for thought. So I think we're seeing a sea change.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of like, really, this is user-created content. I mean, we see this all the time in sort of the virtual world and Web 2.0 and everything else. It seems like we will get to the point of also personalized porn. So, because right now, I mean, if you are a porn production company, as far as I see it, I have no experience producing porn. But even so, you're sort of throwing like your photo set or your movie out there, and it's sort of a scattershot of, yeah, some people are going to get turned on by this. I really hope they pay for it. And you should be able to, with future technology, to plug in the parts that you like. There will be a sort of porn set that you can download and plug in the parts that you want that are really going to be able to turn you on or whatever else. We actually have this in virtual worlds right now, and I did a series of articles on producing porn in virtual worlds where you could do things like make the photo set in the world, take photos, take movies, whatever else, sell that, and then sell the set you made it on, so that if it's a very specialized set, people can actually, they can see what you've done, and then they can go and reenact it themselves if they want to. So you actually get more interactivity and more people making their own stuff, like you said. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's exactly like what I have, like I did a big tutorial on my website, what to do with erotic podcasts, basically saying, you know, take this MP3 file and then make this slideshow with all of your favorite porn, set it on go, and you're set. You can listen to it and you can watch it, and it's sort of like your own custom made, you know, like your favorite nasty porn that you stole off of someone else's website with your favorite erotic story on MP3, and you're set to go.
Yeah, I just wanted to say about the selling sets and selling props and things like that. There's a lot of that done in the poser community, and there's a thriving community, Poserotica. Renderotica. I'm sorry, Renderotica is the name of the site, of people who just trade and make this poser porn. Poser is software packages we discussed earlier that allows people to make 3D animations pretty cheaply, and with requires some expertise, but it's not too hard to do. And there's a thriving community of people who make some of the porn is god awful, and some of it is amazingly gorgeous. Some of it's really something that is just beautiful to look at. I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience, which is that I started out writing porn novels when I was about 18. The market challenges of book publishing have become so extreme now that there's virtually nobody publishing erotic novels anymore as such. I mean, I would sit down and write them in a week and get $600 for them. Nobody's really doing that anymore. The trend is romance erotica, and it's really kind of something that I'm not able to write. So as a result, there's lots of free porn at my website, thomasroche.com. And the reason that I started doing that and started worrying less and less about kind of selling my erotica, I also happened to have a day job which, you know, was more or less in the field and allowed me to basically do what I wanted in my off hours. And so I don't really need to make money at it. But for somebody who's trying to make a living writing as a freelancer, it's really difficult nowadays. It's getting more and more difficult, and it's going to get worse. So I think that the result is going to be more DIY porn, more people like me who just say, well, fuck it, you know, I'm going to find a job that I'm into. And luckily my job happened to be as a writer, but still, you know, and then be able to do what you want and give it away. And I also wanted to talk about another trend, which is the naked woman that I've been forcing Johannes to look at this whole time. This is from this is a short animation that I'm playing largely because I think it's hilarious, but I think there are a couple real good points to be made about it. This is from a program called Sims, which you may have heard of, and this is a game, and people make Sims movies. And this is an erotic movie that was made by a woman. No, this is Hacks. This is Sims Hacks. Anyway, I think that's enough of that. The point that I want to make about this is that as for years we've been told that women don't watch porn, women don't like porn, women aren't into porn, I think it's interesting that a lot of the porn that's coming out of the Sims hack community is actually coming from women, and it actually, to my eyes, reflects what I hear are women's desires. I hear this from women, not just from, you know, Salon magazine. But I think it's really interesting because I think the more DIY porn you get, the more that actually constructs a sexuality and an actualization of sexuality and a reinforcement of desire that is going to be interesting. And it's not just the real extreme, you know, Lou Ferrigno eating you erotica that we saw at the opening keynote of this conference. It's also stuff like, you know, a lot of real sort of romantic, slow, mellow lovemaking, which may be what some people want, and now it's getting to the point where they're, you know, that's something they can create. Any comments on that trend?
I have a comment. I think, like, if I, like, watch stuff like you porn, and so, like, most of the stuff is, like trying to imitate, like, real porn. So it's like they try to make, like, those, like, sex positions, and they don't get it right, and it's funny, but it's not that what I'd like to see. I think it's like, I mean, I'm not talking about like generations, but I think there is like a whole new many people who are like living now with this technology for a couple of years. It's getting from the point where technology really becomes a cultural technology. So I think it will take even like a couple of more years to really like that all those things like U-porn and stuff like that really have an effect, in the effect that there's not this like role model of pornography, like mainstream pornography, but there will be like role models like in alternative pornography and role models in like do-it-yourself pornography. And they might be completely different than like copying like this like strange concept of mainstream pornography that we have at the moment.
I want to comment on something you just said, which is the point that I've done a lot of anthologies, and I've done a lot of online magazines, and read a lot of submissions, and from just general public and unknown writers. And one of the things that is very notable is that people who are beginning writers and people who are writing stuff that just turns them on, and this is also true when you see stuff that's posted on, for instance, Alt Sex Stories or other sources where people are just posting it because they wrote it and they like it, you see that it actually does ape mainstream sex roles a lot. And that's, I think, what makes somebody
in that community sort of a visionary is when they're able to sort of be a little bit beyond that or just do a really good job of retelling mainstream sex stories and mainstream sex positions and re-showing the mainstream stuff but with more vision because, you know, 90% of everything is the same as the last thing you watched, but it's that 10% that gives it a real personal touch. So I think that's a very important point to make.
Did you? Well, I think Johannes definitely said what I was going to say, but also that I think that too, that a lot of what we're seeing too is that people are, they're taking the porn stereotypes and they're exaggerating them to play with them in a lot of ways, just to sort of see like, okay, how can I push, how can I bend, this has been the model, how does this work? But I'd also like to put out there that a lot of slash writers are female, and I think that that's something worth talking about, and you actually know a lot more about that than I do. So.
Well, I was going to say, just to make sure that everybody knows, I don't know how well-known the term slash is, but slash basically is porn that's written. It's written porn usually about science fiction characters. It started out being Kirk slash Spock, almost always gay, almost always written by women, became a very big sub-community in the 70s before the internet. It was traded on paper at conventions, and now is a huge community online, includes all genders and orientations, of writers and of characters, lots of different properties, media properties, usually science fiction, fantasy, horror, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Star Trek, Babylon 5, whatever. Harry Potter is a big one, very big one. And I think, excellent. And I think there's a very good, I think that that's a very good point, that this is a place where a lot of erotic creativity is showing itself, that they're retelling stories from mainstream media, but they're twisting it to make it their own thing, which is exactly what I did when I first started writing science fiction stories, is I read this awesome story, I want to retell that story, but make it more like something I would tell.
And the thing about slash that is interesting too, and that, you know, getting away from the women liking romantic porn stereotype and also, you know, who this stuff is for, slash tends to be really intense, and it's often extremely taboo, and it's really shocking. And about 2 weeks ago, I was talking with a female friend of mine who is a slash Harry Potter person, and goes into Harry Potter chat with other Harry Potter people, and it's very incredibly creative. They role play Harry Potter characters, and of course, the characters are underage, and they're having sex with each other, and they're having extremely transgressive sex with each other. And they met up so often, the same characters in the same room to do, you know, some pretty extreme things to each other as, you know, as characters, young characters, that they decided to have a meetup. And as the story goes, when they all got together and had the meetup, it was basically my friend all in black and stripy socks and Hot Topic and stuff and a bunch of suburban housewives. And it was kind of interesting. But it didn't stop their interactions online. So, but it was just sort of like, oh, really? You know?
And these were all genders. So these were suburban housewives, for instance, playing as boys
all
online?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, very young boys, all of it. Yeah.
And sort of the with what Tina talked about last night, with the fact that porn is picking up technology and stuff, but most porn still runs off of the big tits, big dicks, big cars, sort of like popularity. The simulator cockpit, the mainstream. Well, I mean, the funny thing is, it's you do have to wonder when you once again look at like what people fantasize about, and when they have, when people do post their fantasies to websites or any sort of interactive place, look at how much it really does still affect the stereo, or still maps to that stereotype. There are still people that really want to be the big-titted blonde or the big muscular big-dicked guy fucking in a car. I mean, you see that in a place on the internet, there's so many places where you can convey yourself as anything, to be anything, to do anything, and that's still what's being picked up. So then you get the question of, well, are people finally going to figure it out, or is someone going to come along and tell them?
Right, I guess that's a good question. Is it possible that
porn is a place that people can go to try out those new things, to say, okay, I'm going to be Harry Potter, and yeah, maybe Harry Potter is a mainstream media property, but also maybe Harry Potter represents something archetypal that by playing that character, I'm able to sort of tap into something that's, you know, greater than myself or more complex than the life that I live day to day, that's actually going to help me develop as a person. Or a trans identity. This is a very good point that Violet makes, that people so often play in cross-gender spaces online. And I mean, this is really, really, really common for men pretending to be women or for men identifying as women online. It's something that straight guys having, you know, cyber sex online are often completely freaked out by. But it's really, really common. And I think this is a way that many people... Yeah, true. And they tend to act out the extreme stereotypes of femininity. And I think that it's interesting that people are sort of going going online to sort of explore new identities. And some of them may come to an actual trans identity that they wouldn't have been able to come to as comfortably otherwise. So any comments on that sort of thing? None? No comments? Okay. Fabulous. So how are we doing on time?
I think fine.
Okay.
Fine? I mean... I'm on panel, that's the problem.
Excellent. Well, the next thing, one thing that I want to make sure we mention is that it's impossible to talk about DIY porn without talking about the very basics, which Jonathan Cooper-Smith went over very well earlier yesterday. And that's that the ability to make video porn, to make photo porn, and stuff like that has really come home in the last 20 years. And it's come home so extremely now because people can set up a webcam for very, very little money. It's within, you know, certainly most middle-class people and many people who aren't middle class are able to find the money to set up a webcam site or just to videotape themselves for the purpose of, you know, their own turn on. Yeah, exactly. So I just want to make sure we give some lip service to that. And any comments on sort of that revolution and where that is going in particular now? I think this is an important big point to make also, that the commercial porn industry has moved increasingly away from the idea of big features and increasingly toward the idea of these sort of gonzo productions where men sort of behave really badly and just sort of have a camera and walk around on the street and say, hey, you want to come back and fuck? And this is a woman that they've paid. This is an actress that you recognize from other productions, but they're playing out this sort of fantasy. And that's kind of become the standard for porn. And it's affected that the ease of availability of the technology to make commercial porn videos has actually affected the creative product that is, you know, shown, which is basically a much sort of lower level of production, sort of much lower level of sophistication, for better or for worse. So any comments on that?
That's why I wanted to bring Ian McKay here. Because it's another part of that conversation where it's like, yeah, now that the technology is widely available, anyone can get a DV cam pretty cheap and like go and make their, you know, make their gonzo and do that. But also that, you know, there are other ways that people are DIYing it that speaks to a totally different aesthetic and a totally different type of quality that I think is really interesting. So.
I also wanted to make the point that when I say it's moving away from features, there's actually still a very strong group of features that are coming out of really, really low-budget independent filmmaking that are kind of soft core that actually is a new thing within the last 10 years, I think. But anyway.
Okay. I'm really, like, looking forward to it. I mean, the future will bring us devices that will be so small we won't be able to find them anymore. So... It's really interesting. I mean, you mentioned Jonathan Cooper-Smith. He had this like really great presentation of like the history of do it yourself, not only porn but do it yourself whatever. Yeah, and that's definitely not gonna stop. I mean, people have like devices in their hands that are like that would be like he told it like yesterday, like a small camera that's like a couple of $1,000s of like. Equipment and people working, and you just have it in your hand and can take a picture and upload it immediately. And there's a lot of stuff happening there, and that won't be over. I mean, that's just like the beginning, I guess. So what I find interesting is that there is still a lot of like tech hype about that. So I'm pretty much pro tech, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening. But I think we should be a little bit like consider yourself not going into this hype of like that we have to scream out every day, oh my God, they have a new version, you have to download it. So it's this like, it's getting faster and faster and faster and faster. And like with this like continuous like need for upgrading and upgrading and upgrading and upgrading, I think that people tend to fetishize their like technology but not use it. So I mean, I can still like use like a Super 8 camera from 1968 and do like do-it-yourself porn with it, and that could be interesting too. I mean, there's yep, oh yeah, of course, yeah.
So, and coming from it from the other end, I mean, we aren't going to be seeing every, just because you've got the technology out there doesn't mean you are ready to film yourself in porn quite yet. And I really do see machinima and things like that as the gateway drug, as it were. It's like, well, maybe if you can act out that situation in a virtual environment, if you can direct it yourself, then maybe at some point you'll start feeling like you yourself might be able to act in it. I mean, because you get to the point of right now you build it with your mouse and keyboard, but at some point you may be able to motion capture yourself or something like that, like they were talking about in the CG talk. And these days, the way that people are producing software to do this stuff, I mean, it used to be you'd have one bank of software just to create a full character, and now it's getting so specific that it's either inverse kinematic systems or little tiny joint systems in the hands or whatever else that are so specific that things are going to become so real that people will be able to make that and then hopefully move forward and maybe change their ideas.
Oh, I also just wanted to make sure that I clarify a term, which is machinima is the term for hacking, like what I showed from The Sims, is basically hacking existing software, right?
Well, no, it's not even hacking. It's just using a game engine or a 3D engine of some sort. Okay, well, no, it's usually game engine because it's not like Maya or 3D Studio or anything. It's like using the Half-Life engine or the movies or The Sims or Second Life or whatever else to make an actual movie.
The one thing I wanted to add is just from a practical sex educator's perspective on fantasy versus reality, which is that oftentimes the fantasy is much better than the reality. And so, you know, we may experiment up to the point of trying out the reality, but then discover that the reality isn't exactly what we wanted, or we might find ourselves in an uncomfortable situation. And a lot of porn is just simply fantasy. It's the place that we can go and try on new ideas and look at things that are taboo, things that we would never do in our everyday lives, things that would harm us or harm other people, things that get us in difficult situations. It's you can sort of boil it down to like, you know, the couple that decides that they're going to try and have a threesome, you know, and they fantasize about it and fuck like crazy fantasizing about it, and then they actually try it and it just explodes their relationship. So, you know, I think that, you know, there's the idea of, you know, building up to the fantasy with the technology and then finally putting yourself in the situation of trying the fantasy on and then maybe having it backfire or maybe realizing that, oh, the fantasy is actually a lot better than, you know, seeing myself and going, oh, I really don't like the way my body looks, and I look a lot better with gigantic tits and a tiny Angelina Jolie waist and, you know, just...
I think that's a very good point. And last night on the sex ed panel, I kind of made the point that I thought that one of the destructive influences that porn can have is that it can encourage people too strongly to sort of see themselves in this fantasy role, and that it can lead you away from actually being in touch with who you are, who you really are sexually. And I'm reluctant actually to say who you really are, because it implies that fantasy is not reality. And in many ways, for many of us, fantasy is reality in that it's more intense than you know, real physical reality. And I think that that's very true, and it's increasingly true in an information-driven society. But I think that that's one of the things that I find problematic about this gonzo porn. Gonzo porn is a term, and it comes from Hunter S. Thompson's use of the term, which actually predates Hunter S. Thompson, but use of the term for gonzo journalism, where basically he just, like, you know, grabbed his weed and, like, headed out into some situation and wrote about what happened, sort of without regard for the consequences, and kind of did stuff and became part of the action. So rather than reporting on an event, he became part of the event. gonzo porn is the equivalent with a really cheap video camera, which is that basically you're always aware that the camera is there. So usually the director, the cameraman is interviewing the person that they're shooting. This is done in gay and straight, but it sort of really sort of dominates the straight market. Lately, I don't want to say it dominates the straight market, because in fact there are still a lot of features being made that are more story driven, but there is a lot of gonzo porn out there, and it basically represents a really simple, stripped down version of production where you're more or less in a hotel room or a condo pointing a camera at somebody and saying, wow, so I'm pointing a camera at you and you're going to fuck.
There's no pretense.
There's no pretense, yeah, basically. But I think that's one of the things that can be destructive about that, is that it sells this idea that this is reality, that anybody can pick up this camera and get these, you know, hot women who just happen to be walking down a Miami Beach street and, you know, next thing you know, they're in your condo screwing you. Well, that isn't reality any more than a feature is, any more than, you know, Girls Lie or you know, The Devil and Miss Jones is reality. And so that's one of the things that I think can be problematic about some porn, whereas I think, you know, obviously hentai tentacle porn is not reality, and I don't think a lot of people really think it is reality. Maybe some people, but not a lot. But at the same time, it can be a very vivid fantasy that is, in many ways, as intense as reality for many people, sexually especially.
I mean, Thomas Adlinger had like his whole talk basically talking about like it was a wrap up of like the feminist critique of porn and what art has to do with it and stuff like that. And he also like mentioned like this like authenticity problem with gonzo porn, that like they are pretending that it's like authentic, and of course it's like it's made up like the other porn things. It's like created reality, definitely. Yeah.
I don't find the lack of authenticity as much a problem as it is. It's just sort of annoying. Because you watch it and you're just like, oh, come on, it's so stupid. Let's just fast forward to the cum shot. But, you know, at the same time, I also want to add that, you know, that type of fantasy is equally as healthy a sexual expression for anyone who's watching it and anyone who's projecting themselves into it. So.
Yeah, and I don't mean to sort of criticize gonzo porn as a concept. I think actually, in fact, it's wonderful, it's really hot, and it does. The other side of that is that it can sell the idea that regular people can have sexual adventures, which is absolutely true and very important to get across. At the same time, any sexual representation can set up in the viewer or in the reader a sexual expectation that can be negative or positive, depending on their interpretation.
Yeah, the only harm I see in those types of scenarios is just the lack of safer sex precautions and the type of sex acts that they portray as like being ordinary or being commonplace or being desired, because most people get their sex ed from porn these days. So, you know, they look at something and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, ass to mouth is, oh, I see that in porn all the time. It's totally healthy. And then, you know, then they test positive for hepatitis. And they're like, oh, how did that happen? Everyone in porn seems so healthy, you know, because they're 20 years old. But, you know, that's what I see is the only real, you know, the real potential damage from, you know, projecting too much fantasy without like a little dose of reality into it is sort of like, you know, hey, don't stick that in there yet.
and they're 20 years old, and if they get hepatitis, they don't work for a while. And also, you know, that goes along with the idea that you're walking down a Miami Beach street and you happen across this woman that you just happened to slip $750 to earlier in the day, and she comes back to your apartment and screws you. You know, one wonder of wonders. I mean, I think that's the thing where porn is always going to be a fantasy, and that's fine that it's a fantasy, and gonzo porn tends to sell itself more as not a fantasy.
So. I mean, and that's the possibility for let's call it future porn. That's what I say. I mean, there's like a huge million dollar market, billion dollar, whatever is over billion. I don't know. I think there is a possibility to change that. I'm not sure like to what extent, to what like what percentage can be like reconquered. To really be creative and to really be to somehow like save it out of the claws of killer capitalism. I don't know, but I hope. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're doing this conference, to think about stuff like that. Maybe I'm repeating myself.
So I want to ask one last question of the panelists, and then I'd like to open up to the audience a little bit for some questions. I'd like to ask, what are you most excited about for your own personal creative expression, not what technologies you think are interesting in the marketplace and how they're going to change. What are you excited about sitting down and working on that you couldn't have done a few years ago?
I think the thing that... what?
I'm just waiting for the Jeopardy music to play there.
I'm just waiting for the words to come because it's late and I'm very tired. But I think that what I'm most excited about in terms of, you know, getting the type of sex ed and the type of porn that I want to put out into the world, you know, explicit, hot, all genders, all orientations, free if not cheap. I think the thing that has me the most excited right now is my sheer determination to continue to break down the way that it's distributed and disseminated. That's sort of like my raging, rabid passion right now, is to continue to stay on message about being sex positive and about sex ed and about hot porn and not hiding the sex, being very explicit about the sex and all the different types of sex acts without judgment. But just one of my sheer rabid goals right now is to just get it fucking out there, despite the fact that mainstream media people I'm talking to are like telling me, oh, it's too this or it's too that, or, you know, other publishers are telling me, oh, we can't do that because we need to have this, you know, exclusivity agreement or this deal. And I'm just sitting here sort of like gnawing on myself going, okay, well, I was the second female podcaster and I kind of did it on a dare. You know what I mean? And so now I'm sort of like, okay, how can I break this thing again and tell everyone how to do it at the same time? Like, I want to open source the motherfucker. So.
And can I ask a brief follow-up question, which is it frustrating to you that even though you were the first, or I'm sorry, the second female podcaster, that we've gotten to a place where there are so many exclusivity agreements and so many barriers, that even though the barriers to entry to various art forms, to many art forms, have become so low that almost anyone can get there, that it's still under a stranglehold from corporate America and corporate the world. Is that frustrating? We in journalism call that a leading question.
Yes.
Thank you. How can you say that, you liberal pansy?
This is where I hurl Marxist insults at you.
Yes. Kyle?
Okay, so I guess what I'm looking forward to, or really what I'm going to be trying to do, is just keep on keeping on, as it were, trying to make interfaces and make platforms for people so that they can actuate whatever the hell they want. I mean, yes, for as cheap as possible, too, or as easy as possible. I mean, and that's the thing, is you've got to accept the level of reality you can get it to and know that someone will be happy with it, and then maybe they'll take it a little bit farther from that. Because you can't sit there and try to predict what every single person wants. Sure, it's fun to work on a one-off project for that little certain something. But yeah, making platforms that just make people happy and make people be able to do what they want. I mean, and of course, sex or not, but people always will aim it towards sex. So, yeah.
What can I add? We are a sexual species and we are tool-using species, so, and all the time, nearly all the time, so we'll do that in the future too, I guess. And even like if we blow us like all sky high, I think we'll still do it, so I don't know. What can I add? I have to add that like I'm really looking forward to going to sleep tonight. No. Yes, I fantasize about sleeping all the time, yes. It will be really turn on, yeah. Okay, good. What?
Narcophilia.
Narcophilia. I like that. Okay.
So, did you have more? So, what I'm looking
it does want to get out
to answer my question.
Free mankind. Yep, now.
So
baby steps, free mankind. Baby steps. Yes, yes.
It is pretty hot up here. These lights are really intense. So to
I've been talking all day.
So to make, I just thought it was the conversation, you know. But so to answer my own question, I'm actually what I'm most excited about is actually the fact that technology opens up for me the ability to make money writing with less and less effort. That they're actually, as I said, it's actually become really, really problematic for book writers. And as a result, I largely left book writing behind and am doing more and more on the internet. That's been frustrating to me because I completely love books. And so I'm actually looking forward to being able to do more of the news gathering and information gathering and interviewing and stuff like that with sort of easier and easier technology so that I have more and more time to sort of focus on what I really like to do, which is storytelling. And it's actually less important to me that technology allows me to get that storytelling to other people. I really want to get it to other people. It's more important to me that I'm able to sort of do what I feel obligated and driven to do by the world, which is gather news and gather information and network, and more important to me that I be able to actually do the writing. And the technology, I think, actually does make it a lot easier to get that writing to people. So I think that's good. And I think what you talked about in terms of book publishing, and I'm talking about paper books and ebooks, but particularly paper books have become remarkably, the barriers to entry are actually very low with print-on-demand publishing, which has a lot of problems, but it's still so much easier to publish a print book than it was 10 years ago that I think that is really promising that there may actually be a rebirth of books. Which I love, because I love books. So thank you very much to everyone. Yeah, go ahead.
Now I know something.
Oh, okay, please.
Okay. I'm a big fan of dead media. There's like an endless variety of media that died. The typewriter. I don't know, like a cup of... the overhead projector, whatever. So there's like an endless list of things that died in horrible ways and not so horrible ways, but they are dead and gone. And I think it's really like a technology, like especially if you use it in a creative way. Technology sometimes stimulates creativity and sometimes it blocks it even. So there's like always this like two sides of it. So you shouldn't be like too... You shouldn't enslave yourself with technology. So just because it's possible to Twitter or to blog or whatever, like this like special format, like basically to a certain extent dictates your creativity. And I think it's always like it's always interesting to think outside of the bun. So it's like it's really, really, really interesting and important to look back in media history, especially if you're like working on a daily basis with media and technology. You should have like sometimes like think about what happened in the last like 200 years like concerning technology. And that's, I think, a good way to immunize yourself against like unnecessary hype, I would say. Because if you know that a medium dies, it will be dead. And if you know that, I think that's the brightest future you can have when you think about it.
Well put, and a very, very good note to end on. So thank you very much to our panelists. And I think I'd like to open it up for a few questions. Do you want me to do it?
You.
Okay. And I'm hopefully not going to drag the Sims porn onto the floor, because that would really be a shame.
One thing I'm finding that's a common thread as far as a problem with like being able to distribute DIY projects is, well, distribution tools. We have a lot of like really, really kick-ass distribution tools, but they all end up sooner or later having some kind of a huge problem, like the problems with Flickr or the problems with LiveJournal. So what would your fantasy distribution tool look like? And this is probably the... $64 million question, how can you create something that's self-sustaining without turning into a big, huge corporation that you have to get venture capital into that ends up turning into the same thing again, you have to build another one? That That seems to be the question, and just wondering if you guys had any ideas on that.
I mean, it's just a matter of what you want. I mean, there's this group called KLF, and they burned £1 million. They had it. They had £1 million, and they burned it. They made it with, like, they made this, like, are you familiar with, like, KLF and burning £1 million? Yeah. I mean, KLF tried to, like, they basically emulated a hit, and they had a hit. So they had like a number one hit single in the UK, and they made a lot of money, like £1 million with it, and then they burned it and they filmed it.
I just wanted to clarify.
I think that's cool. Like, yeah, if somebody,
that
if
is pretty awesome.
If you have a startup company and then somebody comes and then you burn it. But then actually you wouldn't start one. I don't know.
I mean, really to specify, what I mean is being able to like make it self-sustaining, because I mean, you know, equipment is not free. Bandwidth is not free, and that's like really where the barrier seems to come in. Because I mean, you know, I remember a time Flickr was the best thing ever, but then it got big, and then they got investment from Yahoo.
It was designed by gamers too, by people who were originally game designers.
Right.
So I think that's kind of important to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. So. So, well, yeah, and I mean, I guess the best thing we can say is, well, support open source. I mean, it's as long as we have free stuff coming out, sometimes it may suck, but it sucks for free.
I think that we can also do as much as we can to do our part to sort of like raise the level of awareness and sort of normalize sex as much as possible so that the companies that are, I mean, basically, like, you know, Flickr's having a problem managing clusters, basically, is what's happening. And it's clusters of people with a variety of interests and a variety of level of morals, you know, where you're talking about, like, you know, well, community standards, you can't apply community standards to clusters of people who are all over the globe with a variety of interests, you know. So what we need to do, I think, is to, you know, continue to do what we're doing here and raise the level of awareness about, you know, the patchwork quilt of human sexuality and sort of normalize it, but also try and educate the companies about, you know, about having liaisons with these communities that they may think are fringe or taboo, and help sort of, you know, whether it's like me screaming online and getting a lot of attention or someone, you know, actually starting a company or working within a company to say, okay, well, we are going to, you know, I think Second Life actually did a really good job with it, where they basically said, okay, people are going to sexualize this product. You know, we're not going to stop them from doing it. We're not going to pretend they're not doing it, you know, but we're not going to also go out there and be like, hey, we're a big sex playground. But, you know, we're going to just sort of like, you know, let it organically do what it's going to do. And I think that that's a really good, strong business model. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that some of the people who work there also work at San Francisco Sex Information. So they're sex educators by nature, and so have an understanding of the fact that people are going to be sexualizing these technologies. And I think the ideal, you know, sort of content delivery system would be something that would be, you know, for someone like me, something where I could, you know, upload digital media, have them process it for me, do the transaction processes, you know, and then let me deal with the legalities on my side and let me be responsible for my own legalities for whatever storefront I decide to put that into. So that's the other half, I think, of your question there. So does that make sense?
If it's possible, like concerning like national laws, because in Austria there's a big discussion nowadays if there should be like some kind of censorship concerning like sex in Second Life, and if an avatar,
Germany too?
And yeah, Austria and Germany, basically the same discussion. So if an avatar looks like under like 18, should the avatar be able to have sex, for example, stuff like that? There's discussion like that really like happening at the moment in Germany and Austria. The Austrian, like, I think he's like the Minister of Justice, something like that. He basically proposed this like ban for like young avatars, or I don't know. Whatever.
Well, I just kind of had a comment kind of triggered by your initial question, which is about, I have one.
Ah, you have one.
Yes. About creating sustainability in those. And that's the part of the consumer, is that, you know, we get free products from all these people. They aren't free. People are paying them to have access to us. And if we want to have access to the stuff we want to have access to, we have to be willing to say, okay, it's worth $5 to me to put in a tip jar to have access to that rather than having to get it through Google or get it from Flickr. And that's going to be about redefining what we want as consumers and not saying, I want something for free, but saying, what's going to serve my needs the best?
Yeah. Flickr does cost money unless you just don't use it very much at all.
I want to make a comment on that, which is that Marty Klein, who's a he writes has a blog called Sexual Intelligence at WordPress, that he wrote about the fact that certain cell phone providers are now proposing that they're going to pick up phrases in the conversations that you're having in order to target advertising to you. So this is something that is becoming greater and greater, and it's becoming more and more like Big Brother, and it's really quite terrifying.
Okay, but there's some really cool technologies coming out of that, too. Like, so,
Kyle's going to be co-opted by the man before the rest of us. Pretty soon he's going to be wearing like a robot suit and be saying, no, the government's on your side.
Well, no, but actually in terms of...
I want to fuck advertisement.
It doesn't matter, the ramifications.
It's just so fucking cool. Well, no, but the idea of social, I mean, when you're tagging your photos and stuff, and the idea of aggregation over social networks, I've actually been doing some reading on this lately, of there's now services that will take the tags off of your photos, and then they will go out to your friends list and take the tags off of all of their photos to give them some sort of context. So say if you're trying to figure out whether you're talking about Beetle the car or Beetle the insect. Then, so remember, you put this data out there too. So, as we talked about. And that's the thing is, even though, you've put that data out there, but we can help you with it too. There's so much talk about, information hygiene, privacy, and whatever else. But remember, it is still, we can still do really cool shit with it. It is fun. It's not all bad, and we're not all like going to be living in a police state because of our Flickr tags. We can do cool shit with it, okay? I mean,
but that's what I wanted to basically like add. I mean, there's nothing like Big Brother because we're all small brothers, and we all do it every day. I mean, we don't need any surveillance out there because everybody's like basically writing everything about like themselves on Facebook and whatever it is. So, I mean, there's this like really strange like interest in like putting out as much private information about oneself as possible. Like, and that's a little bit. I find it a little bit. I don't know. I mean, like possibly like in 5 or 10 years, when all the kids that are now like 1 million hits on YouTube will try to get a job. I don't know. But.
You guys, this because we have a question out here, and that cord is actually very short, and unfortunately, my computer is preventing. There we go. All right, I think we had a question over here.
Yeah, it's actually just some comments on kind of the democratization of porn. You talked about YouPorn, PornoTube, XPeeps, those kind of free sites. Those are generally fronts for large porn organizations. Most of the videos on there are uploaded by studios, so they're not really a democracy version of porn. XPeeps is done by ABN, which is one of the largest, you know, adult companies online. Another comment to make there is the DIY sort of model, like an eBay or an Etsy sort of thing for porn, that exists already too. That's clips.com. Again, a large organization runs that. That's national A1, hotmovies.com. Personalized porn, we already have that. One of the sponsors of this event actually does that today. And so similar to Amazon, you've been watching these clips.
Would that be a video box?
I'm not going to mention it, but...
oh, you have a sticker of them on your...
Never mind.
Because if there was a company named Video Box doing that were a sponsor of this conference, we would want to talk about Video Box.
I'm not going to talk about my day job. It's scary enough. But one of the things that's really interesting is we're implementing a lot of the features you mentioned are already there. So the recommendation already exists. That's live today. So you've been watching these videos. Other people that watch the videos like those videos, you should go check out those videos.
And I can go see those at Video Box?
Under Second Life. The other thing is we've noticed some really interesting problems with adopting some of the Web 2.0 features. The biggest one has been recommendations and comments. So we now allow users to leave comments on videos. And this has gotten a little bit dicey because essentially a lot of the stereotypes are really well played out in comments. All of our gay content is really popular in the Midwest, not on the West Coast or the East Coast. Generally, people only like anal and gonzo. All these sort of stereotypes are very much true. And when you're a Walmart of porn, you see kind of this large trend. It's totally true. We live in this bubble of tagging things and being very open. But generally, if you're in the Midwest and you're paying $10 a month, you don't care about tagging. You don't care about RSS or whether it's H.264 or any of that sort of stuff. You just want to get off and have a good time. So I think we need to think about the general consumer, too. What are the features that they want? How can we improve their experience and educate them on some of these features, like the privacy aspects? That's a really big issue. We have an opt-out feature. Amazon doesn't, you know, so we don't have to track your stuff if you don't want us to. So I think it's definitely a user education that needs to occur, just like Violet mentioned, on the privacy aspects.
She makes a very, very good point that there are a lot of people in the Bay Area who barely know how to use computers and who have no idea. And also there are a lot of people we're fond of saying we live in a bubble in San Francisco. We actually don't. Maybe within the boundaries of San Francisco, it's a slightly more liberal bubble. But boy, man, you cross that bridge, you go into the East Bay where I live. Wow. It's really different, even if you're just in Oakland or Berkeley. It's really different. It feels very different. Yes.
So I actually want to answer Thomas's question, which is what am I looking forward to in the next few years the technology is going to bring? And it's in response to some of the stuff that each of you has been saying. Kyle was mentioning how when you create new technologies, you shouldn't just be doing it in a vacuum, like in your basement, and then like years later be so far ahead of the curve that the average person, as these two people have been reminding us, has no idea what you're talking about. But then another point that you guys have been making is that people given access to new technologies to create their own porn recapitulate all the same stereotypes that we are accustomed to seeing in mainstream porn. So you see big tits, big cocks, whatever. What I'm looking forward to is people getting their hands on these new technologies and asking themselves the question, how many people do I need to show this to? How many people do I need to be famous for? I'm not trying to be, you know, Vivid and make a movie that I can sell for a huge amount of money or that I can put in front of thousands or tens of thousands of people. Maybe it's okay if I make something and 500 people see it, but they all really liked it. So that more individual creativity and more individual sexual expression ends up actually getting put out there in the world. So I'm hoping to see that.
I think that's a really good point, and I want to make a point that I sold 1,700 copies about of my first short story collection, which was all kind of gothic science fiction erotica, and my next two collections sold, I don't even know. It was a very much higher number, and that was more. That was something that I still felt positively about, but I felt was less personal to me, and I take more pleasure from having sold 1,700 of these sort of what I see as being kind of iconoclastic representation of what I'm into. So I think that's a really good question. Any comments from the panelists on that?
Yes.
Good point. Thank you, sir. Good.
Well, questions and comments. One of my biggest ones that I was waiting for was to Violet. How do you see yourself promoting like the open source? Because I know that you're doing your own for audio blogging or translating it to scripts and whatnot. But how do you see that developing so other people can do it and follow your model or even work with those other people to make a bigger way of like basically like a Flickr or something or an iTunes without all that bullshit behind it?
Well, in terms of sort of getting the message out there or getting the content, the idea of the content out there, I'm planning on relying pretty heavily on just just blogging, basically, and just sort of the power of meme passing and making the content super, super affordable, super easy, and making it as distinguished as possible from everything else that's out there content-wise, but also just sort of like, you know, style-wise, and also like DRM-free, and, you know, and really pushing all these different aspects that really go against the grain of what a lot of the mainstream companies are doing with their digital media. And then, you know, I have a lot of belief in the power of the meme and the power of blogging and the blogger mafia. So, and I plan to rely on that fairly heavily just to sort of get the message out there and also use the mainstream channels that I have access to at this point, because I'm, you know, as someone who, you know, is coming from blogging and going, you know, stepping into mainstream media and getting burned by mainstream media, but also having a lot of fun with it at the same time, I'm thinking like, I always am asking myself, am I using this power for good or for evil? Well, I'm going to do a little bit of both, depending on how you define it. But I'm going to use the mainstream media channels as well to get the messages out there that we're all talking about and getting the content distributed that way as well, just by saying, hey, look at this shiny thing over here. So.
I want to really quickly say I don't know if we've defined DRM, digital rights management. It's basically, I don't have a lot of technical knowledge, but it's basically something that companies put into a digital media file in order to prevent you from trading it.
Good.
He's tired.
I'm tired.
It's dirty media.
Okay. So, what is DRM? What is DRM? And now I want to hear the crowd say DRM is?
Bullshit.
Not what it is. I've heard it already.
Bullshit.
Yes.
Yes. Bullshit.
And I think Violet makes a good point about it, which is that as a small sort of, let's just presume, for the sake of argument, under the radar producer of arts, and I think this is very true in music, this is very true for small bands, digital rights management is just Satan. It's really, really bad for people. And big companies are very in favor of it because they perceive that it protects their content from being taken without getting paid for, I think.
Though there is one thing, DRM is kind of like failing in the marketplace to a huge extent. Like even on iTunes, like about a fifth of their catalogs, like I believe it's EMI made their entire back catalogs available with no DRM at all through. Okay,
but me and my friend really have fun with our Zune.
The one thing I'd like to dovetail onto that really quickly is that I had a big conference call meeting with some of the largest literary agents in New York about 2 weeks ago, and they literally said to me on the phone, we're praying that 14-year-old boys don't become interested in e-books because they're terrified that people are going to crack their precious DRM. And of course, I'm sitting there on the phone going,
right.
It's too late. You know, it's out of the box.
But that's right. One thing that I think is worth mentioning, that it's going away on its own.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Can we please, go back to the days when we wished that 14-year-old boys would pick up a book and read something, for Christ's sake? I don't care what it is. I don't want it to be erotica, because that would be wrong. It would be really, really wrong for a 14-year-old boy to read erotica. For Christ's sake, if they would just pick up a book, I don't care if they pay me for it.
She actually had multiple questions. And I thought
really okay. My last train leaves in 20 minutes.
Yes.
I have to go.
You're not allowed to go. Not now. All
right. One last very quick one.
Okay. Another question that I wanted to kind of express is that how is, again, going towards the younger crowd, that was one of my bigger things that I don't think is really talked about, is how do we get this message across to the younger generation that doesn't quite have a lot of access to any sex exploration because it is so limited to them, that anything that might even be talked about as an educational point or even like a conference like this, you have to be 18 and over to be here. And I know that as when I was younger, which really wasn't that long ago, I just wanted to know, and like I would lie about my age just so I could get the information more than anything else, because it's so goddamn limited out there.
I mean, we'll put all that stuff online like pretty soon, so.
Yeah, and really too, I mean, as kids become more kids become more online savvy. I mean, they already are. I mean, that's been the stereotype for a decade as is, and it's just going to get worse. However much we try and stop them, we are not going to stop them. I know. I was that kid.
I wasn't thinking so much as stopping them so much as, like, there's a lot of, there's, I mean, there's the tech-savvy kids, and then there's the kids that's going to be growing up to be the general America that really isn't that tech-savvy, that are the people that are really much the people that are the people that I feel are the ones that need this information, not just the ones that are, like, mm-hmm. gunning for it, because those are the people that are going to be taking up your shoes or following in your footsteps. I'm thinking more about the broader spectrum, the people that are going to need this just basically for basic survival, or, like, not just hearing what they want us to hear in school, I guess.
Right.
Because it's all just so, like, vanilla, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's important that people like me and people like us are getting our shit into iTunes and thinking about the way that we're doing it. And personally, myself, it's amazing that my stuff is in iTunes, considering what is on it and the type of things that are talked about on it. And I'm putting as many Easter eggs in there as possible to, you know, to give the people who are accessing the content on the mainstream level different routes to go and different ways to find information that isn't necessarily on the face of it. So we need to be subversive in getting our messages out there and making them, you know, being like, oh, and if you're curious about this, there's this site over here. Can't link to it, but here's the link spelled out, you know, that sort of thing. And just, like, just keep planting the information and keep planting the information. So, all right.
Yes. One. Did you have one last really, really quick comment? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. It's kind of a loaded question that goes back to what you were talking about earlier about how there's this growing group of people who are, or rather growing market of romantic novels, and it's becoming harder and harder to publish more interesting material. And Violet was talking about something I've definitely seen myself, this very intense erotica being published by very common people. It seems like there's nobody, or at least I'm not seeing in even these areas, nobody's really talking about the moral, ethical ramifications of being able to create what you want, talk about what you want. But everybody seems to be doing it. And at the same time, you've got this group of people who are, for the first time, you know, in their lives, like, you know, say, housewives doing freaky Harry Potter porn, you know, for the first time in their lives, they're going to the extremes. And, you know, are they talking about, you know, I personally could care less if two consenting adults act out about sex between two 13-year-old kids. You know, I mean, personally, Harry Potter is, you know, I don't want to know about Harry having sex with anybody, and I choose not to think about that. But, you know, there's, it's...
You're talking a lot about it.
I'm sorry, I went to, like, a LiveJournal page with, like, Snape having sex with Harry, and I was like, wow, I could have lived my whole life and not seen that, you know. but I was curious that, you know, it seems like there's everything is still happening in closed doors, and even though people are finding and gaining access to all these wonderful things, because, you know, if you're really into, you know, teenage, you know, freaky bondage Harry Potter stuff, that's great, but it seems like as more and more that's happening more and more behind closed doors, the outside world is simply constricting the simple stuff that people are getting access to. So the people who just want to, you know, do the simple stuff can't even do it. Who's talking about that?
Comments?
My comment would be that we live, like, nowadays, we live in a society, like, if you turn on the television, like, in the afternoon, you see, like, stuff like Jerry Springer and stuff like that, like, all over the planet, not only here, but even, like, in Germany and Austria. So there's this, like, constant, like society itself, like, late capitalism itself, like, tries to find the borders, so what's possible, because they want to market nearly everything. They want to subsume, like, all kind of, like, dissent. They will just, like, absorb it. But, like, so you turn on the television, you see, everything is possible. I mean, there's stuff like Jerry Springer. I mean, like, there are no boundaries. I mean, there's like that's total like popular culture is total transgression, yeah. And then like if you talk to the people next door, I mean, it's like total normal conservative, whatever, yeah. So there's this like strange world of the media, and there's this strange world of everyday life, and there are a couple of points where they intersect, but they are not so, like, there are not so many, like, points where they really like intersect, or where they really like where something interesting evolves out of it. I would say.
I think that the media is our rotting and putrefying soul as a society. And on that note. I would like to say before I close the panel, and I'm very sorry, we are out of time. I know some of you may have had questions you didn't get a chance to ask. But I just want to, before I end my panel, I want to say what a privilege it's been to be here at Ars Electronica, and what a great conference it's been. And thanks very much to Johannes and to the other organizers and to everybody who helped make this happen. This was really something else. This is some really important work, and thank you to everyone for participating, and thank you to all you diehards who are still here in the audience.